Alan Kring Productions in association with the Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Financial Management, MBA 440 for Spring Semester 2022.
Tonight, the Federal Reserve System. This is the ending lecture for this MBA course. Were you to have a course that had two nights a week, I would go on in the second night to give a lecture on ethics. But, I mean, that's kind of a trivial subject anymore. But the purpose of this lecture is to bring out into the open the subject of interest rates and how those interest rates are actually forming at their base, that risk-free rate, as it were, and all rates above that. You've seen the capital asset pricing model. The risk-free rate is there. The risk-free rate is like a substrate. That rate, no rate can be below it because why would you take a risk if there is, you can get more from taking no risk whatsoever. So when I say the risk-free rate, as I've noted before, the general proxy, the actual interest rate we see that we can use for that is the rate on a very short-term treasury bill of the United States government, simply because there is no risk of default by the United States government. So that instrument has no default premium. It has no risk premium, and it is as liquid as money, cash money. As a matter of fact, as I will talk about later, and I'll say this now just to make that point clear, cash and treasury bills are entirely interchangeable in terms of banking systems level one capital. In other words, banks have to keep a certain amount of money on reserve that has no risk whatsoever to it. Now, that would mean that they have to keep money in the vault to satisfy demand deposits and all that. But they can also keep treasury bills in their vault as well because they are just as safe as money, as cash money. In other words, what we call tier one capital that all banks have to keep a certain amount of in their as their required reserves that is set by the regulators. Every bank has to have a certain amount of money always there that can be used if there people come in, they need money, or someone cashes your check. The money has to be there to satisfy that demand deposit claim. So at the heart of it, a treasury bill is money. For all intents and purposes. The only difference is that a bank can use money to lend out above its reserve that's required. It can lend money. It can lend capital for home loans, car loans, and all that. It cannot do anything with a treasury bill, though. It just sits there looking stupid. It cannot be used for any purpose of the bank other than to satisfy its required reserve of Tier 1 capital. And Tier 1 assets, I use capital, but it's more like just saying it as an asset. So there is a focus that needs to be brought to bear here at the end on where is that risk-free rate coming from? What creates the interest rates? Now, obviously, there's a free market component to it, supply of money and the demand for money. Where they intersect, that equilibrium is the price of money, the interest rates. We'll get into that a little more here in just a minute or two. But before I do that, I'm going to take you back to the stock market one last time and just make some quick mentions of things about the day in the stock market and go on to mention a little bit about yield curves as I had earlier in the semester. But as you can see, the markets were generally bearish, but they came back from the opening bell and they climbed back out and they were finished the day up a little bit. Now, the Dow Jones is a portfolio of 30 of the biggest stocks basically in the world. It is very safe. So low risk, low expected return. It doesn't go up much. It doesn't go down much. So you can invest in that portfolio if you are a very defensive investor. Now, more aggressive would be the Standard & Poor's 500. That is an index of 500 very large company stocks. There will be more risk in that. They are still huge companies, so there's not much likelihood that they're ever going to go bankrupt in any significant numbers, that is. But there is more risk involved. So you would expect them to go up and down by more than you would the Dow 30 index. Now, the NASDAQ is an actual exchange. Tens of thousands of small cap companies trade there. That would be where you would see the most risk, the most up and the most down. So like on a typical day, when the Dow is up about a third of a point, the S&P is up a little more, about a half a percent, and then the NASDAQ would be up or down, in this case up, the most, more than two-thirds of a percent. And that's a typical day. Greater risk, greater expected return. So there you are. And I ignore the Russell, heaven knows what it's up to. Now, a couple of other notes here. Crude oil is a commodity. It's a special commodity because it is highly used. And they essentially, it's driven entirely by supply and demand dynamics. The traders want this price to get, I've been telling my 240 class, watch. It will fight tooth and nail right now. It wants to get to about 125 a barrel. It had a downstroke because of the release of a million barrels from the strategic reserve, but that gets eaten up pretty quickly, so it's back on its way up above $100 a barrel. Now, the cutoff of oil coming out of Russia and Ukraine, but Russia mostly, caused the price to go up. However, that's not a lot of what's going on now because there's a lot of cheating going on. At first, there was a lot of compliance, but now a lot of countries are figuring out ways around the sanctions to get their hands on Russian oil. India, Turkey, China, and even some of the Western countries are finding ways to get to Russia's oil. So Russia is not really the root cause of the price of oil going up right now. There are other factors involved. But at the same time, that could turn the other way. If we go into what a number of analysts are now expecting within the next 2 weeks, the use of nuclear weapons by Russia, that may invoke at least partial invocation of Article 5 by NATO. That would really clamp down, and the price of oil will go through the roof if that happens. But right now, oil is trying to crawl its way back up from where it was a few weeks ago. It had gotten itself back down, but now it's coming back up. Gold and silver are commodities. You put your money there if you want ultimate safety. If you are afraid of a global collapse of the financial system, you go to metals. The old saying is from stocks to bonds, bonds to gold, gold to bullets. We hope we don't get to that last stage of it, but there you are. I've got mine already in order. A new, I think 10,000 rounds will be enough to fight off the zombies. But anyway, as you can see, investors are putting their money right now into equities. They're moving toward risk. There is a sense that everything is stable now. We'll get into more risky. And that means that they're going to not be putting money into commodities. Now, if the investors are getting out of stocks, the first thing they would do is invest in bonds because they're the next stage of safety after equities. Debt is cheaper than equity because debt is safer. The debt holders have to be paid before the stockholders get paid and all of that kind of stuff. So we would anticipate, we'll see if investors were moving toward bonds today. Now, what you're seeing is yields on this, on the 10-year benchmark treasury. So the price would be going in the opposite direction. Survey says the 10-year bond was going up in yield about 3.5 basis points, which means the price is going down, which means investors are getting out of bonds. They're getting out of bonds. They're certainly out of commodities. They're going to equity. So that means that there is a positive sentiment right now in the markets. There's a feeling that things are going okay. And so there is a little bit of bullish sentiment there. How much bullish sentiment? Well, the bulls these days are pretty skittish, so we'll see. Now, if you look over here on the other side of the world, this is London. London finishes up 6 hours or 5 hours before we do. So this was kind of like early this morning to about midday, and then that market closed. As you can see, it crawled out of a negative situation. So the bulls took charge, and by the midday, it was in bullish positive territory on the FTSE 100, which is an index of 100 large companies on the London Exchange. The Nikkei has just awakened. Trading is just starting there. The sun has just come up over there, and so you can see that it started with a bull spike. But that bull spike has lost some of its steam, and it's beginning to slide here in the early trading over in Tokyo. Overall, though, you can see that the world's heavier markets seem to be in something of a positive mood right now. And that may last a while, but there's still a lot of fear in these markets. So we have to see that, too. There is not nearly the volume that you usually see over a historical period in the trading on these exchanges. In other words, a lot of the heavy investors are just holding their water, keeping their money in money markets and other cash equivalents, and just staying on the sidelines. So no matter whether you're seeing a bull or a bear market right now, most likely that is just the marginal traders, the heavies, the fund managers, the Wall Street boys and all that. They're staying on the sidelines, and they have been for months now, waiting for the next shoe to drop. They're not going to stick their necks out. They're not stupid. With that as the backdrop of this, we go back here and we talk about the yield curve. Now, I had mentioned this early in the course, an inverted yield curve where a longer yield is below a shorter yield is called an inverted yield curve. It is a signal that a recession is coming. The yield curve inverted a couple of months ago, and I will show you current year. And as you can see, it was not inverted. Ignore the 30-year, it's a weird thing. And it stayed clean, you know, rising, maturity premium increasing with increasing maturity, nice, smooth, upward flowing yield curve. But then something happened. It's the 7-10-year leg started to show weakness. And if you look here, the 7-10-year leg started getting closer and closer, and there you go. Right there on the 18th, the yield curve inverted on the 7-10-year leg. We will have a recession. 9 to 12 months out, my forecast is mild to moderate recession, but it'll happen. Well, you'll say, well, wait a minute, fat boy, what if the yield curve rights itself? Too late. Once it inverts, that's all it needs. You will most likely have a recession. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. Sometimes a yield curve will lead to just an economic pause. But if you look down here, it got freaking nasty. Let me get up here. You saw an inversion there. You saw, where was that nasty inversion that started up? There we, come on. Where was it? There we go. Look at that. One, two, three. Three legs of inversion. And then you had one, two, three, four. It got really bad. It has begun to right itself now. You see this? It is now, the inversion has even disappeared. It's flat on the 710. So it's coming back to a normal pattern, upward sloping. Doesn't matter. We already had the inversion. But if you look at the overall picture, look at a one-year treasury. Come up here. Do you see how the rate has been getting progressively larger and larger and larger overall? That's the actions of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is clawing back the money supply. Too much money creates inflation. If the money supply grows at the real growth rate of the economy, you will have neither inflation nor deflation. You cannot. If one company jacks up its prices, there's not the money to feed other products. Substitution effects will just control the situation. It is only when too much money is printed for the real growth rate of the economy that inflation can happen. And that's what we started to do. Back in 2017, we started printing money at much faster than the rate of growth of the economy. And then it kept going on. And then when the Fed was beginning to get the guts to pull back that money, claw it back in, contract the money supply, drain liquidity, and I'm showing all the terms that I'll use tonight right here, well, then we had the Biden administration and the Congress started printing COVID checks. Not one round for everyone, not two rounds, but three rounds. We don't have enough tax base. Our taxes are incredibly low by historical standards and by the standards of developed countries around the world. So we can't pay for all of that with tax revenues. We have to print money if we're going to do that. And we have printed it, and there was already a sensitivity because of the liquidity overhang from the 2017 to 2020 period. So here we go. Inflation is raging now. It is the natural consequence of printing more money than the economy can absorb with its growth. So there you go. So the Federal Reserve has gone from injecting liquidity into the economy, which ultimately, in the short run, it boosts the economy. But in the long run, all it does is create inflation. So the Fed has now gone from high liquidity, adding liquidity to the economy, essentially printing money like there's no tomorrow, and now it has got to go the opposite way. Hence why the yield curve begins to invert. The markets know that interest rates are rising. Rising interest rates reduce the present value of future expected cash flows, and therefore the value of the economy begins to fall because the present value of the future expected cash flows is going down because interest rates are going up. You saw the equation. It's in the denominator. Always the R is in the denominator of present values. So when that R, that interest rate, goes up, well, you're saying, well, what interest rate are you talking about? It doesn't matter, because if the risk-free rate is going up, all interest rates will rise above it because the risk-free rate is the substrate. So here we are now. Interest rates are rising aggressively across the board here. You see it? And hence, we will go into a recession. It will essentially clean out the dead wood that has been building up for some years now. It will also probably mean that the party in power will be kicked out, because no one's going to understand that this had to be done. They don't think on that level. You are in a special position. You are highly educated, and you are even more educated because you've had such a great professor here. So you will know what the average person doesn't. Well, this inflation is just ridiculous. Now we got these interest rates going up. Well, goddamn, that's just the president and the Congress. We're going to have to kick the rascals out. That's how they'll see it. Can you stop them from seeing that? Go ahead and try to educate them like we do here. Really. I mean, they're going to want to know when their next beer is showing up or all that. This is the political reality behind what we are doing right now. Unfortunately, the Federal Reserve, well, I'll get into that now, but Let me get this down here, and I'm going to talk. Now, in your resources tab, there is a folder called the Federal Reserve. In that, there is a link to one of the Federal Reserve's education sites. It tells basically what I'm telling you here, except not as well as I am. And then there is a 15-minute cheesy, stupid, animated video that the Federal Reserve of St. Louis made some years ago. But it is actually covers the subject fairly well. It was made, okay, the Federal Reserve creates, one of its things that it does is education stuff. I mean, you can find games. Why would you want to do that? But they have games there. They have all kinds of videos and explanatory stuff. And you can order pamphlets. They'll even come to your school and give you a lesson plan and talk to the students about what they do. They do their best to make their operations as transparent as they can. And you're going to see that there is a historical reason why they need to do this. There will always be conspiracy theories out there about the Federal Reserve being controlling the world, and the Federal Reserve is controlled by the Illuminati and the Satanists, and most of all, the Freemasons and the Jewish conspiracy group. Now, I'm a Freemason. I can assure you that we do not want to control the world. We just want to control the money of the world. And the only reason we want to do that is so that we can have people give us money so we can eat free of charge at our monthly meetings. Yes, we call ourselves the Order of the Knife and Fork. And don't ever repeat that. We march around, we make weird symbolic gestures, and then we go eat. Thank God for the Eastern Star. Those ladies make a damn good meal. Okay. I'll start with a historical background. In the 1600s was a time, the Renaissance, was a time of extraordinary change. After the Dark Ages, especially after the Black Plague had come through and wiped out maybe a third of the people in Europe and Great Britain. I mean, once that had happened, you know, the whole world changed. Yes, it was sad that so many people died, but at the same time, there was a lot more food. And, you know, if you lived through the zombie apocalypse, sir, you lived and you stuck your head up and you looked around, you're alive, and all your friends are dead. I mean, yeah, you're sad that they're dead, but I mean, they've got Nikes in their house that you can take. We saw revolutions. Explorers started saying, the hell with being afraid. We're going to go places and find things. You know, people in Europe and Great Britain had not been down to Rome. All they knew was that it fell and there was nothing there. Well, a couple of explorers went down there and they found out it was vibrant and alive. And they were doing things like making, not those stupid stick paintings like this. They were doing beautiful paintings and sculptures and naked people and novels that weren't about going to heaven or hell. They were writing novels about romance and love and sex and stuff like that. And the people started saying, you know, the hell with this tunic crap. I'm going to tie it up. Yeah, see, I've got a body. It's pretty cool. Let me sew this dress together so I'm not walking around like a Scotsman and things like that. The world was waking up. And as a part of that, commerce became real. You started having trade fairs across the Europe and the United Kingdom. There were these where international traders would go with goods and, you know, spices and foods and pottery and clothing, and they would exchange. Well, how the hell do you exchange in a world like that? Well, banks started showing up. real banks that would communicate with banks in other countries, and they'll say, yeah, we'll issue credit slips so that when he comes back with his goods, our guy comes back with a credit slip from his bank, and we can swap that way. Banking, real banking, almost like checks, like currencies that were being accepted around these nations. And this, of course, these banks were mostly financed or owned by the large, powerful families of Europe, the Medicis, and others of that kind. And there were the Jewish banking interests and the Gentile banking interests, but these were real banks. And some of them came to great strength and prominence in their nations, in Italy, in Germany, in the Germanic lands, as they were, the Austro-Hungarian area, and in England, banks. Well, the interesting thing was that the sovereigns, the kings and queens, they saw this as a positive thing because they could finance their operations through these banks, and they could use these banks for their desires. And so we had this symbiosis of these banks and the sovereigns of their respective nations. Eventually, almost like it wasn't official until the 1700s, but some of these banks began to take on the aspects of what we would call a central bank of the country, a bank of the nation sort of configuration. By the 1700s, this had become official in a number of countries in Europe. These countries had central banks that were managing the money supply, providing banking services for other banks, and regulating the smaller banks. Yes, you can operate. No, you can't. You are out of line with our capital requirements. You are okay. Essentially becoming like almost like a sovereign's banker that would make sure that everything moved smoothly within that nation, as far as financial transactions and money supply and all that went. Well, along came the United States in the later 1700s. And they saw the European models, men like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and the world travelers, and they saw the need. This would be something that was important to our country, would be to have this kind of a central bank. Oh, that wasn't going to fly, though, not with the American attitude. No government is the best government. We ain't going to take no orders from Washington. President George Washington? Well, yeah, you hear in the books about how everyone loved him, a great hero. He cut down a cherry tree and he couldn't lie, so he got his ass beat for admitting it. That whole thing. Oh, I come from a part of the country. My people come from the Cumberland Gap. And I mean Pennsylvania Dutch and Tennessee and Kentucky people, to this day, they hate George Washington because he and his whiskey cronies wanted to monopolize the booze market, so they sent out federal troops to smash the stills and kill the people who were making the moonshines and the whiskeys and the hard ciders. They smashed their stills, shot them if they got in the way. And so there wasn't a whole lot of love for a central authority. I'll tell you something funny, tiny, tiny little tidbit. We say the United States of America. Well, you know, back in that time before the Civil War, they would never have said that. They said these United States, not the United States, these United States. States' rights were preeminent. The Constitution was a treaty among the states, but that they still saw it as the states were sovereign, and they still had the supremacy, even though the Supreme Court had ruled early on that the federal government was supreme. Take that as a backdrop. There was not going to be a central bank in this country. No way we're going to let those Washington boys run our lives. There was already a great deal of bitterness in the South, because all of the financial power was located in the North. The banks were, the shipping magnates were, and so there was a lot of hatred of that whole system and how they saw it as being tied to Washington in that time frame. Well, we got to the Civil War and things changed. Mr. Lincoln kicked ass and brought everyone under the rule of law. But in that early period, there were a couple of attempts to create the beginnings of a central bank. The first national bank was at the very end of the 1700s and the start of the 1800s, and that was shot down right away. Didn't even get on its feet. Even though I think Alexander Hamilton was behind that, but it just wasn't going to fly politically. Then, a little while later, a second national bank formed. This got on its feet. It got liquidity, in other words, depositors, and it had a big fan club, and Washington was behind it. And then, unfortunately, we got a president elected who was, by almost any account, a complete asshole. His name was Andrew Jackson. He was a genocidal murderer of Native Americans, as if George Washington hadn't been in his early years. But, I mean, this guy was just, he saw himself as a populist. I'm here for the people. I'm not here for the fat cats. Of course, Andrew was a very wealthy man himself. But what he did, he sent federal troops to the Second National Bank branches, raided them, shot people in them, and took the money out and gave it to everyone. Well, of course, that was popular, but that was the end of a central bank, even any thought of a central bank, for decades. Only after the Civil War were there even peeps of it. But the problem was that the banking system was a fiasco in this country. Every bank was issuing its own money, paper that was a money. And then you had all the con men and the liars and the cheats, the scammers, running banks. One of the stories that most people don't know about were what were called the sod banks. Have any of you ever heard the term sod bank? Oh, they were a real trip. Every boom town, when there'd be a gold rush or anything like that, there'd be a boom town, and a sod bank would set up. You put your gold in here, and we'll make sure it's safe. Yeah, we're right here in town. And, of course, what would happen is when they got enough money in that bank, those scoundrels would just leave town, and their paper that they had given people as deposit receipts, money, was worthless. Sod bank money. So, I mean, it was just a terrible situation. And then you had the sophisticated cons going on. Now, as I had said, banks keep some money in their vault to satisfy demand deposits. Now, you don't want to keep too little in there because then you couldn't satisfy a normal day's flow of demand. But you don't want to keep too much because the way a bank makes money is to lend out some of that money to people to make interest, and that's how the bank profits, and through other means too. Well, what I can do, you're a very responsible banker. You've got a 15% reserve ratio of money in your vault. Well, here's what I'm going to do if I don't like you. I'm a rich, powerful person. I might even run a newspaper in town. Hey, you guys heard? He doesn't have any money in his vault. He's spent it all on himself. You think I'm lying to you? Why don't all of you, run over to the bank and try to get your money out? Go ahead, do it. And they'd all run to you, and you say, what the hell? I don't have all that money. Even though you're responsible, you buckle right there. Run on the bank, and you're dead. See, I told you. And then I get your bank at pennies, hell, half pennies on the dollar, and then I set up my operation, and I take your money. That was a fun one. That one was running even into the 1920s. Some of the rich, powerful banking families in the United States used that. It was just a charm. If you had the influence, especially if you had a newspaper or a broadsheet, or you had connections to other means, social media of the time, you could cause a bank to collapse that was actually a very responsible bank. This was a disaster. There would be banks, one bank, well, your bank has sucked, so, oh my God, his bank probably sucks, so we'll all run that bank. You would have collapses of like a domino, And it wasn't just a microeconomic problem. It began to have macroeconomic consequences by the 1880s, 1890s. It was a disaster. Recessions, we bitch about a recession that's four quarters. You're talking about recessions that could last a decade back then. And a lot of it was because of this lack of any control over the banking system. Now, here's the thing. The government of that time was the best government money could buy. It was literally a government where the senators, judges, president were pre-selected literally in back rooms by a bunch of old, fat, white men smoking cigars. They would decide who was president, who the judges were, who the police chief was, all of that. They controlled the government. Now, even at that, though, things got so bad in different areas of business. It wasn't just banking, that there started to be legislation trying to crack down on some of this nonsense. The first one was the antitrust legislation of 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act, because these monopolies were basically jacking prices up so far that people were rioting. The rich people were even getting screwed, and the government was getting screwed on contracts. So, I mean, in the middle of this very conservative, free market, laissez-faire world, they started saying, the hell with that. We got to pass some laws here. And so that was sort of like the warning shot. And then in the second decade of the 20th century, we had a very odd little period. We had a liberal president and a fairly receptive Congress. And they got to work trying to deal with some of the messes. And one of them that they dealt with was the banking mess. Now, here's a thing about law. It is one thing to pass laws, thou shalt not. It's another thing to enforce laws. Now, when you've got capital crimes, murder, bank robbery, rape, and things like that, that's the police can do that. That's what they think their job is. They're not well educated, so they can crack down on the thugs. But when you get to specialized kinds of laws, you can't really ask, well, police, go and stop that bank from doing that, or stop that con man. There's no way to do that. So it came in that time frame that in order for laws about a certain subject to have any meaning, the Congress would also have to pass legislation that created an agency that would oversee the interpretation and enforcement of the laws. A great example in modern times was the Environmental Protection Act. They created, at the same time as the environmental laws, the first environmental laws, they created the Environmental Protection Agency, which would have the expertise to know how to interpret those laws and promulgate the regulations down to the level of the those who would need enforcement. Agencies became very clear in the 1930s, for example. Well, no, it was before that. In fact, the antitrust law that I told you about, 1890, it was virtually unenforceable because there wasn't an enforcement mechanism. By the time we get to the second decade of the 20th century, Congress said, now, wait a minute, we're going to need an agency for this. So they created the Federal Trade Commission to oversee antitrust law and translate it into legal action. It happened in securities law, the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Securities Act of 1933 created the Securities Exchange Commission that could articulate securities law into action and enforcement. So this is actually the way we do it in our country and in other countries too. Now, we had actually tried one in 1866 or something like that, but it didn't work very well. But anyway, in December of 1913, Congress passed and the President Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. It was a complex of laws that addressed banks. Now, it wasn't, quite admittedly, it wasn't too successful in its first decade and a half of operation. But it was there and it had power. In order to enforce this, the Federal Reserve Act created a semi-private agency called the Federal Reserve Bank. And more broadly, the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve, at the top, has seven governors comprising the Board of Governors. Now, a trick question on the final. There are seven governors and one chairman. That's false. The chairman is one of the seven governors. These people are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Historically, the Board of Governors has been, the governors have been consummate professionals from the banking industry, from possibly political side, but they were very strong, very knowledgeable, very well-educated people. That has come not to be the case in the 21st century. Some of the board members are still outstanding individuals, although they may have ideological, quite wide ideological differences. There are many of them are still great, but you now have some who are extraordinarily, how in the hell did that person get on the board? So it's not as high quality as it used to be. As a matter of fact, there's one. She was, before she was a governor, she was appointed by Bush. She might have been appointed by Obama, I'm not sure. I remember writing about it at the time. She had run a community bank that what got in so much trouble it had to be taken over by Wachovia Bank. And in fact, they actually paid her for her to promise she wouldn't even come into one of their banks anymore. She was so incompetent. Why was she incompetent? Because her profession before she ran that bank was that she was a dinner theater actress. And she is, I believe, still on the board. Well, no, I think she finally gave up. She got confused one day. But the Board of Governors, these are the people who take banking laws and interpret them as regulations. In other words, banks don't see laws. They see the regulations that have been promulgated by the board. So the Board of Governors regulates. Now, the Federal Reserve Act created a system that the country would be divided into 12 districts, and each district would have a district bank that oversaw banks in its territory. Now, interestingly, here where we are actually close to the border of two districts. The Chicago district is above us, and the St. Louis district is below us. We're, I think, about 40 miles inside of the Chicago district. Although, interestingly enough, I take students on tours of the Federal Reserve, and I usually go down to St. Louis. Each of these banks kind of has a thing that it is well known for. Like, for example, the St. Louis Fed, their big thing is education. They are the ones who produce, you'll see, the St. Louis Fed made that video that you're going to see. And they do all these things for grade schoolers, high schoolers, college students. And it's a great place. I took my students down there. The last time was before the pandemic. They throw jobs at people. They want, And they would love to have ISU students down there because they say, well, all we ever hire are kids from Mizzou and places like that. And they'd love to have us. And, you know, they pay for your education, clear through your PhD. Imagine having doing your PhD with all those databases in the world sitting there at your fingertips. They provide for huge benefits, and their pay is insanely good. No, not one of my students wanted. They all wanted to go back to Chicago because that's where mom and dad live. So the hell with it. Seriously, it drove me crazy. They were, you know, jobs. Yeah, but that's not where mom and dad live. They live in Schaumburg. Okay, whatever. F that. I mean, I went to the Chicago Fed is not a very friendly Fed. I will tell you that right now. They all have, you know, you can do tours. But there in St. Louis, they set up a room with speakers to come in. They had one of their head economists talk to my students. Up in Chicago, yeah, there's a room where you can see the money being shredded and all that. You know, I tried to follow my students in the room, and this big woman with a nightstick slaps me on the hands because she didn't want me in there with them. And I thought, you know, damn, bitch, that hurt. Turned out she was great. We had dinner. But where the hell was it? Oh, okay, here. Okay. Now, the 12 district banks, each one has a president. So there are 12 bank presidents. Now, they work with the board directly. Now, these cats are the cream of the crop. I mean, they are highly educated in finance, economics, and accounting. They've been in the industry for a long time. They're just like, I've been in the same room with two of them over my life. I mean, they were, you could just tell they were very different people. You know, they've never had a traffic ticket. They've probably never had sex. I mean, they're just that perfect. But at the same time, I mean, these cats know their stuff. These are the ones who take the regulations and supervise the banks in their district. So the Board of Governors regulates, and the district banks supervise. So that is the first of the three duties of the Federal Reserve. They regulate and supervise the banking system. Now, there are banks that are not Federal Reserve in the Federal Reserve system. Many banks are, but there are other banks that are regulated by other agencies. The Comptroller of the Currency has a number of banks that it audits, and the FDIC has its banks that it audits. And the states, if it's a state-chartered bank, they would probably be watched over by the state regulators. And then the credit unions have their own system altogether. It's a crazy quilt. What was funny was after the disaster, the banking disaster of 2008, Congress brought them in and said, we got to get it all under a single supervised system, all of it. Oh, you should have seen the turf war when that happened. You know, there's the comptroller of the currency. You ain't touching our banks. Try it, cupcakes. And the FDIC, the state, you know, no one was going to give up territory. So it's still the crazy quilt of regulation and supervision that it was pre-2008. So there you are, whatever. Okay, now, let me go on to the next step here. What was I going to say? Oh, these banks, the original Federal Reserve, the bank, district banks, their territories are the same as they were when the Federal Reserve Act was passed. But the nation is very different now. Back then, the population and the banks were concentrated on the eastern side of the United States. So those districts are really small, lining up and down the East Coast. And then out there on the West Coast, back then, there weren't that many people out there. So San Francisco was this bank, had this huge area of supervision, which is now an absolute nightmare because that is where a lot of the banking activity goes on. And so it's, It's a wild ride working in the San Francisco. But each of these banks works with the U.S. Treasury. Now, what is that big letter right there? And what is the wording around in the circle around it?
Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta. So this was printed at the Atlanta Bank. Yes, they print the money for the Treasury. So why would they do that? Well, you see, our U.S. government does not tax enough to pay for all of what it does. Everything from social welfare programs and entitlement programs on through to military defense and all of that. Our government doesn't have the money to do that. So in order to pay its bills, it has to borrow money. It borrows money from any Tom, Dick, and Harry that it can. How does it borrow? It issues treasury paper. Okay, so the Federal Reserve goes to the auctions of that treasury paper, just like the Chinese do, the Arabs, the Japanese, the big trust funds from Canada and the Nordic countries. Our Federal Reserve goes to the auctions and it buys treasury paper. In other words, it lends our government money. Now, wait a minute, fat boy, didn't you say that the Federal Reserve is part of the government? Well, sort of and sort of not. But you see, here's the interesting thing is, they print money, and that is how the government finances its operations that it can't finance through taxes. Now, I want you to look up here at the top. What is that wording right at the very top of that? Right there.
Federal Reserve note.
Note. Well, didn't I talk about bills, notes, and bonds? Notes are promissory instruments 1 to 7 years, 1 to 10 years in length. So in other words, this is representing a debt that the Federal Reserve is saying the country owes to you. And it will be due in 1 to 7 years. Well, how do they pay it off? Well, that's easy. They take this one back when it's old and worn out, they shred it, and they print one or two more. That's how our system works. Now you're saying, whoa. No, don't look too closely at it. Did you ever see the old cartoons with Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote? Did you notice that he never fell off a cliff until he looked down? For God's sake, don't look down. Where the hell? Okay. That's its first job. The second job is that the Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Banks have to put their money somewhere. Someone has to honor their checks. That's done by another bank. Now, there are private banks that do this, commercial banks. I believe Citigroup has a commercial operation that does banking for banks. The Federal Reserve does banking for banks. But here's what the Federal Reserve Act said. The Fed, acting as a bank for banks, cannot cheat in competition with the private banks. It must not charge super low fees to break their backs or anything. And the Federal Reserve is charged with the duty of advancing the technology of banking. And then it has to share everything that it creates with its competitor private banks. Everything. Those little magnetic codes down there at the bottom of checks, that was the Federal Reserve that created that. And then it just gave the technology to all the banks in the country. The way the ATMs work, that was the Federal Reserve that did that, created this complex system so that you can get money out of an ATM or you can pay for your food at Walmart. That was the Federal Reserve. And then it just gave the technology, shared it with all of its competitors. And it works. Someone asked me when I was doing this lecture some years ago, they said, maybe 5-7 years ago, they said, how many banks use the Fed for their bank and how many use some private commercial bank for their bank? And I actually didn't know, and I called a former student from long ago who works at the St. Louis Fed, and I said, okay, what's the answer? How many banks? He said, well, I can give you percentages for the Fed or for the St. Louis district. He said about 60% of the banks at that time used the Fed and 40% used some private commercial bank for their bank. It was a perfect balance. They don't hurt each other at all. And obviously, commercial banks are doing this, so apparently it works. And the bank for banks thing, the Federal Reserve, from the fees that it gets for its banking services every year, it gives its profit to the U.S. Treasury. How much? Billions of dollars every year. It just gives it. Okay, we made this much from our banking operations. Here, U.S. Treasury, it's all yours. Now, here's the interesting thing. This is an example of where a government service can operate in complete harmony with a private service. They don't damage each other. They keep fees low because there is competition, and technology obviously is going like crazy in this kind of an environment. So when the healthcare debate started raging in the late 2000, around 2010, a few of us were saying, you don't have to say nationalized health insurance or free market private. Why don't you set up a system like the Fed has for banking, where the U.S. government could provide a health insurance and private insurance could provide health insurance, and they could coexist. We have a century of data that it works. Well, guess how popular that was? The leftists and the right-wingers both shot us in the ass for even thinking of something so stupid. I wrote several articles about this, and I was lulled off the internet for the idea. But it works. So think about that in your futures, that sometimes it's not an either-or. It's a combination, a hybrid system. And in this case, it works. Okay, here's the last one, the big one. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. In other words, it manages the growth rate of the money supply. It depoliticized. Do you understand that politicians had control of the money supply like they have control of the tax rates? What would happen? Yeah, print more money. Yeah, I want to get reelected. Print money, print money. And then we'll blame someone else when the inflation comes. This was supposed to take that out and put it in the hands of technicians, of the technocrats. If you grow the money supply at the real growth rate of the economy, you will have neither an inflation nor a deflation. It takes it out of the equation. There is one and only one cause of inflation, and we keep trying to get this through people's heads. It is not because minimum wage goes up or unions jack up their contract. It's not because of greedy corporations gouging people with prices. You hear that bullshit all the time. It's not true. Only one thing creates inflation: too much money being printed. That's all. If you can keep, and this said, Fed, your job is to maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. That's a fancy way of saying don't let inflation or deflation happen. Grow the money supply as a technical consequence of the real growth rate of the economy, and we will be fine. That takes it out of the problem of the economy, and then we'll leave taxes to the playground of the politicians. At least we had one under control. Unfortunately, the Fed didn't always abide by this. It would see recessions and print more money, and then it'd see the inflations and it'd contract the money supply. It was doing it all along, even though it really wasn't supposed to be doing this. It did it. And then, in the 1970s, for God's sake, the Congress passed and the president at the time signed number 4, help the economy. You are there to be part of the solution to our problems. So in other words, that fourth was an official recognition that you couldn't do number three. And trying to explain this at the time to those bozos, they actually, most of them knew that this was, they were passing a law that would make the Fed's original number three virtually undoable in the short run. But they did it anyway. And so we had the insane inflation that happened in the late 70s that had been started years earlier, because essentially we had Eisenhower was a what I call the last of the real conservatives, the kind that I have always seen myself. You know, don't do anything radical. Tax cuts, for God's sake. He gave him a tax cut in 1954, and he said, no more tax cuts. But then there was pressure in the civil rights area, and especially in poverty, which was a real big, huge problem in the 50s, lest anyone not know that. And he said, I don't want to fund that either. We're going to keep a middle ground here. So he was all in favor of, you know, the Fed not being a helper. Let the economy find its own way. Let social programs grow in a slow way. And he especially said, beware of the military-industrial complex. In his final speech to Congress, General Eisenhower said, we cannot get involved with business in that incestuous way. Leave us out of that whole equation. But then we had Jack Kennedy come in, neoliberal. He saw it all as a war. We are going to have a war on poverty. We are going to have a war of technologies to race to the moon by the end of the decade. And we are also, by the way, Kennedy hated communists. We are going to stop communism in its tracks in Southeast Asia in this little country called Vietnam. And by God, all those programs are going to cost money. Now, we had very high taxes, comparatively speaking, back then. But I mean, eventually, it got to the point by the 1970s, especially with the OPEC oil embargo, we just printed money like hand over fist to shut people up. People were having a fit because prices of things were going through the roof, oil. So money started being printed. And then after that, it got to be like crack cocaine. The Federal Reserve just kept printing money. Every time the economy would begin to slide a little bit, more money printed. We had Gerald Ford. His solution to stopping the inflation, he had, I think, like hundreds of thousands of buttons printed that said, whip inflation now. Win against inflation. Of course, that does nothing. You've got to cut the money supply. Claw back those years of liquidity overhang. He didn't have the guts to do it. Originally, the next president, President Carter, he starts out with another jingle. His was, I see inflation as the moral equivalent of war. Well, unfortunately, he didn't think about the acronym, moral equivalent of war, meow. God's sake. But unfortunately for the economy, he was actually a trained nuclear physicist. He understood the equations. And he, in 1979, appointed a board chairman, Paul Volcker, who was a complete asshole. He just cut the money supply. He brought it down. Of course, when the money supply goes down, the price of money goes up. So interest rates, the price of money, went through the roof. They already had a massive inflation premium in them. So by the time we got to the 1980 presidential election, interest rates on home mortgages, 25%. Yeah. Carter was kicked out of office after one term, and we had the era of Ronald Reagan, who looked like a frickin' hero because by the time he got in, the liquidity had been drained and the interest rates were beginning to slide back down. Volcker wasn't doing it. He was just keeping the money supply throttled until everyone believed him that there wasn't any inflation anymore. And then he began to ease up on the money supply a year or so later, and everything looked great and rosy. Okay, conducting monetary policy. How does the Fed do it? There are three ways. Now, the first way is a meat axe approach. The Fed sets the reserve requirement ratio. How much money banks have to keep in their vault. If they have to keep more money in their vault, that's more money they cannot lend to get to keep the economy going. So if it increases that required reserve ratio, that will slow down the economy real fast. Like I said, that one's a meat axe. I mean, it's really, really not something that they do to control the money supply. One place where you saw they did do it, right after the attacks upon the United States of September 11, 2001, the Federal Reserve upped the required reserve ratio, and it trucked money in literally convoys to banks because they thought people were going to freak and they were going to run the banks. You know, the country's going apart. And so they increased the required reserve ratio to make sure the banks had plenty of liquidity to satisfy demands for money. And they also pumped massive amounts of money into the banks, literal cash money into the bank, into the banking system. Interestingly, though, much to even my surprise, people didn't freak. They didn't run banks. They just went home and looked up to make sure there wasn't an airplane coming at them. It was kind of odd. So the Fed then took that liquidity out of the economy. Okay, that's a meat axe. The next one is the discount rate. The Fed sets a rate at which it will lend money to banks. At the discount window, we call it. Now, this is more like a signal. Well, the Fed increased the discount rate by 0.25% at its Federal Open Market Committee meeting today. That's more like the Fed is saying, look, interest rates need to come up. And this is where we're putting them. And it will put them up at 0.25% increases, once in a while, maybe a 0.5% increase. But it will move it up just to send its message to the banks of the economy, your interest rates need to come up so that there's not as much lending, so the economy slows down. It can do it the other way. It can lower the discount rate, and that would be a signal from the Fed, banks, bring your interest rates down, make more loans, get the economy boosting, moving. So it has that kind of, they do this officially 8 times a year, but they, if there's an emergency, they might do it more than that. Now there's another way the banks can borrow money. They can borrow money from each other. You see, the pool of money that is in all of the banks is called the federal funds market. It is this vast trillions of dollars of the deposits of banks' monies at the Fed or whatever bank they've got it at. This is but there's a supply of that money at any given time, and there's a demand for that money. Where they intersect is an interest rate called the Fed funds rate, the federal funds rate. This rate is set by the market. It's interesting, you'll see these. Now, the Fed will say, we want the federal funds rate to get to here or to here, but they can't set it. It's a free market rate. You will see every financial news network will say, well, the Federal Reserve set the Fed funds rate at, no, they didn't. They can't do that. They can say where they want to target it, but they can't set it because the rate is based on the supply of and demand for those bank funds in the federal funds market. How would the Fed move the Fed funds rate to their target? Well, that is where the most common of the operations happens. How common? Every day. This is called the open market operations, the OMOs. Now, this Federal Open Market Committee comprises the 7 governors and 5 bank presidents who serve on rotating terms. Here's what the FOMC will say, all right, we want liquidity drained from the economy. So the orders go from this committee meeting to the domestic trading desk, which is at the Empire Bank in New York City, the Federal Reserve's District Bank in New York. And the desk sends the message to the traders, drain liquidity. Now, the traders, in their inventory, they have a mass of treasury bills and they have a mass of cash. So what they start to do is they immediately start working with the banks all over the country. Now, they want to get rid of money. They want money out of the system. They'll call the banks and say, we want to sell you treasury bills. We'll send you treasury bills. You send us cash money. Well, the banks will say, well, okay. You know, banks have both. They're both tier one. So, okay, you're going to send us treasury bills if we send you money? Okay, we'll do that. And that is how the economy gets drained of liquidity. The Fed funds pool begins to fall as the banks send dollars to the Fed, which shreds them. And essentially, the Fed funds rate begins to rise because the supply of money in the federal funds market begins to sag because all these traders are selling treasury bills to the banks and getting the banks to send them money, which the Fed then just shreds. Now, suppose it works the other way. The FOMC says, add liquidity to the economy. The message goes from the FOMC to the domestic trading desk at the Empire Bank, and the desk manager tells the traders, add liquidity. So then the traders call the banks and say, hey, listen, we want to buy some of your treasury bills. Cash money for those treasury bills. Are we talking? And the banks say, okay. And so the banks send them T-bills, and the Fed sends money to them, which sinks into the federal funds market, raising the supply of money in the federal funds market. Now, it sounds complicated at first, but if you think about it, it actually works. And how much does it work? Well, here's the funny thing. You are in a place that's like a bubble of knowledge that almost no one in the world, in the country, understands. Many politicians don't even understand it. But what are we talking about as far as this OMOs go? On the order of tens of billions of dollars every day. Now, the OMOs right now are heavily tilted toward contracting the money supply. So those desk traders are calling banks and saying, we want to sell you treasury bills. And if we sell them to you, you send us money. And they're going to take that money that has been building up for these 5-6 years, and they're going to just shred it up and throw it away. And that will contract the money supply. At the same time, it will cause interest rates to go up because the supply in the Fed funds market is going down, so interest rates will elevate. And there's another reason, too. If the Fed is selling treasury bills, what that's going to do is the supply of treasury bills is going to go up in the open market. Supply goes up, price goes down, yields go up. So there'll be a double whack on the economy. Interest rates are starting to rise. That yield curve, that is the open market operations in play. You saw that yield curve. Remember you saw those interest rates going up on all the different maturities? That's OMOs being done. The traders taking money from the banks and giving them T-bills, which they can't do anything with. That is how our monetary system works. That's what drives interest rates. And the interest rates are what drives the health of the economy. These interest rates rising, those are the denominators in those net present values of future expected cash flows. As those interest rates rise, the net present values of projects and values of corporations go down, and so the economy begins to slide into a recession. That's all that's happening now. When I explain it like this, it might be still fuzzy to you, but you see that this isn't voodoo or magic. This is engineering. This is just the management of a modern economy. It's kind of a fun subject when you realize that this is a story that is not about evil Freemasons and conspiracies, and you know they're just trying to ruin the economy so they can turn us into a fascist state or any crap like that. No, it's all engineering. We have to do it now because we can no longer hold it on track. The Fed has to let the help the economy. The economy, President Trump thought the economy was sagging, so he got very angry with the Fed, ordered them to print money. They were afraid of him. They thought he said he was going to fire the chairman, which he probably couldn't have done, but that freaked the Board of Governors out. So they just, okay, print, print, print. And so we had printing money, and then that tax cut down to 21% corporate, that wiped out tax revenues. So we had to print money if we wanted to keep the economy going. And so money began to overhang. The liquidity overhang began. Then the Biden administration, trying to keep the economy from collapsing because of the COVID lockdown, they went into printing money for checks for everyone and all that. Student loan forgiveness, well, that's going to be money that's gone. We don't have to pay. We're not going to see those cash flows. So we had to print money even more. Ultimately, you can't violate the laws of physics. It's called the equation of exchange. You should have been taught this in economics, and I'll bet you weren't. M times V equals P times Q. The velocity of money is generally constant, even though people say it isn't. So if you print money, M goes up. In the short run, prices will stay the same and your output of the economy will go up, the Q. But in the long run, as those dollars begin to soak into the economy, output will go back down again, and instead, prices will go up. It's that simple. And no, there isn't. Well, there's a difference of opinion. Yeah, there's an opinion that's different among idiots. But if you want to build the bridge and have it stay, you believe in the science and the engineering. That's where it stands. Now, let me show you something. The Federal Reserve has swung wildly in its control of the money supply. Once you go off the track of just keep it growing at exactly the real growth rate of the economy, once you come off that track, it can swing very hard up and down and back and forth like a wild animal. And that is a major problem. Let me show you something here. Now, I was a writer for many years on economics, finance, education, politics, a few social issue articles. But in the period leading up to the crash of 2008, I was waving warning flags saying, we are in real trouble. You see, there are actually three levels of money. M1 is transactions money, bank deposits, cash in your pocket. Now, that's the one the Fed can control. It prints. You saw the money. It prints it. Now, there's another one that is that money plus these timeshare deposits of rich people and rich corporations. And then there's a third one that is that second one, which has the first one, but it also has a nasty, huge component called euro dollars. In other words, all of the money that we pay for toasters in China, for cars from Japan, that is what is called M3 money. And it builds up in the foreign reserves of those central banks over there, and then they lend it back to us so we can live beyond our means. That M3, the Fed has no control whatsoever over M3. Except for that little part that's the M1 and maybe a little bit of the part that's M2, it has no control over M3. So what did the Fed do when M3 was going wildly out of control in the first decade of the 2000s? They stopped publishing M3. They said no one uses it. In other words, there's no dead body here because we buried the dead body. So let me show you what was going on. At the time, the Fed had stopped publishing M3, but there were private services that were still tracking it. What I said was, oh, by the way, this spike right here, that was when the trucks went out with the money for the banks. Remember when I told you about 9/11? They filled the banks with money. M1 skyrocketed. Okay. Here's what was going on. M3 was plowing upward at an insane. This isn't the amount of money. This is the growth rate of M3. Was heading toward about a 15% growth rate of M3. That's unsustainable. And even M2 was growing rather crazily. So what did the Fed do? They brought the growth rate of M1 down. Do you see that? That's almost a zero growth rate. The economy was growing at about 2 to 3%, but the Fed stopped printing money that businesses and households use. They just shut it down. Do you see that average growth rate is about 0% there? That was what caused the collapse in 2008. Essentially, there was no more oil being poured into the engine of households or businesses, and the economy buckled. I called it in June, and several other economists did too. No one believed us at the time, but on September the 15th, it all came home, and we came within about 2 hours of apocalypse. Literally, Western civilization came nearly to a halt. The Fed saved the day there. It wasn't some housing bubble or any crap like that. It was just the M1 had been cut to zero, so the economy didn't have the lubricant of money, of cash and demand deposit money, to keep functioning. That was the cause, and it's right there. The Fed was still publishing that at the time. I want to make one quick mention before I finish for the night. This spike right here, remember I said, oh, that was those trucks going out to get all of that money into the banks, you know, so that people, if they ran the banks after the attacks, everything would be okay, the banks wouldn't buckle under the runs. There's a problem with my story. Do you see that those trucks were on the road in July and June and in the first week of September? Do you see that they were pouring the money into the banks at least a month and a half, possibly 2 months before 9/11 happened? That spike was the day before the attack. This was about 6 weeks before the attacks. The Fed was already filling the banks with money. There really was just one gunman. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.